Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast in hours two. I am your gregarious, loving Pisces bottom host, TJ, and I'm joined by
the horrified Aaron,
who is a Aries. I will leave the rest of it to his discretion, as he may see fit. And as always, we're happy to come before you to offer our humble yet grandiloquent observations about various queer media. So what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about some gay stuff.
We are talking about some gay stuff, which is pretty on brand for us.
Yes, yes. So this time we're talking about a documentary, which is actually a departure for us.
It is true. It is our first documentary here at Queens.
And so in keeping with the themes of our podcast, we got like to keep it gay. Doing a documentary, but it's a documentary about the gayest person who ever lived, Rock Hudson.
Correct. It is the new documentary, Rock Hudson, All That Heaven Allows, which is a great title, I think, given his Hollywood history. And
one little thing, All That Heaven Allowed.
Oh, yes. Sorry. My bad. Rock Hudson, colon, All That Heaven Allowed. And I will emphasize the colon. Anyway, it is a really insightful look, I think, at Rock Hudson's life, his career, his obvious closeted status as a gay man, which I think is a really valuable thing to talk about, and I'm glad that it's found release, especially since, you know, as we'll talk about as we move on, like, there's some issues with a lot of it being by voice rather than in-person interviews, which I think is a function of the pandemic, so you could still see the way the pandemic shapes so much of media. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what did you think about the movie?
In keeping with what you were just talking about, I want to start by talking about the use of those voiceovers as opposed to in-person interviews, because sure, it may have been sort of an artifact of the pandemic, but I think one very nice thing about that is that it, oddly enough, as much as I wanted personally to see all of the, you know, big celebrities who were interviewed for this, it was nice to just sort of hear their voices without always seeing them, because it kept the focus on Rock Hudson himself, I think. I mean, I would have been great, it would have been great for me to be looking at, you know, contemporary footage of Piper Laurie and Cal Burnett and all the other folks they got talked to about this, but I'm kind of glad I didn't get to see all that.
Right, that's not to say that there aren't many in-person interviews, because there are, which we will get to, because there's Amistad Bonpas and several of the other kind of gay men that Rock Hudson interacted with throughout the years, so I appreciate that. But as you say, I like the fact that it sort of draws our attention repeatedly to the, like, the documentary evidence of Hudson's life. Like, we see excerpts, obviously, from his many movies. We see, you know, sort of intimate photos of his private life. We see some, you know, recordings and so forth. So I think that's really valuable, as you say, to draw attention to the material reality of what remains of Rock Hudson, even now, like, almost 30, well, several 30 years after his death.
Right.
So, obviously, if you don't know who Rock Hudson is, perhaps we should talk about who he was.
Yeah, there are people who might not know who Rock Hudson. Oh, wait, the young people.
As I say, there are young people, which I presume some of our audience are on the young side. I don't know that for a fact, but I like to think that we're relevant to the youngsters. So Rock Hudson was arguably one of the most successful and well-known stars of the 1950s. He had a career slightly in the 40s, but the 50s is when he really shone. And he really sort of hit his stride in the soapy, sudsy, richly textured, technicolored melodramas of the German film director Douglas Sirk for Universal. Some of the big ones are All That Heaven Allows, Magnificent Obsession, Written on the Wind. Like, these are the sort of triptych of Rock Hudson's true, like, meteoric rise to sort of the apex of Hollywood stardom. And then, of course, his second great break comes when he has the sex comedies with Doris Day. And I will say, on a little personal note, that I first fell in love with Rock Hudson when I was a child, watching these sex comedies with my grandma, and only subsequently was like, oh, yes, okay, this all starts to make sense. But anyway, we can get to that later in a deep cut.
And for me, I'll talk a little bit about that, too, because my intro to Rock Hudson was more based on his legacy as already having been a big star. Because it's not like he disappeared after that sort of era of movies with Doris Day. He continued on doing other things, making other movies, and then worked in television for several years after that. On into my lifetime, when I was a little kid in the early 80s, he was, you know, still working. Still showing up in things. And I remember seeing him and having my parents talk about how he had been this big star. So even as a small kid, I still had some sense that this guy was really, really famous. Not just someone who was famous and popular right at that moment, but someone who had been a major influential figure
right.
for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, most people in the 70s knew him from Macmillan and Wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he had his, like, final big role in Dynasty, where mm-hmm. he was a guest star. But, of course, if Rock Hudson is known to people nowadays, largely it's because so much of his star persona has now been, I hesitate to use the word overshadowed, but I will, because of the circumstances of his death.
Yes.
He obviously contracted AIDS. I shouldn't say obviously. He contracted AIDS, which was a huge deal, because he was the biggest sort of person who had been publicly acknowledged to have contracted the disease.
Yes.
And also it brought spotlight onto the fact that, you know, he'd been living as a gay man pretty much his whole life, mm-hmm. just very deeply, arguably closeted. Although mm-hmm. not very, as I think the documentary repeatedly points out, it's not as if he was, like, celibate.
Yeah, exactly.
Far from it. Like, he, like many other gay men in Hollywood, perpetuated the myth that everyone was straight, but lived his sort of libidinous, exciting, scantily clad gay life, you know? Which is a really fascinating aspect to the doc that I found really valuable.
Yeah, and that's something we're going to discuss more in this episode of our podcast, is that idea of the kind of double life that Rock Hudson had been leading for decades, that was interesting because I'd seen things about Rock Hudson before watching this documentary. I'd read about him, you know, many, many times before. But even I didn't really have a sense of the extent of sort of the nature of that double life, of his queerness being sort of open to the people who knew him and all of that kind of stuff, while still being this major sort of Hollywood secret and therefore kind of a secret for the world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I also appreciate about this documentary that was also done by an earlier film from 92, Rock Hudson's Home Movies, is the way that it sort of pulls out excerpts from his various films and his filmography and then decontextualizes them so we can see the innuendo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Rock Hudson's Home Movies, that has a more biting edge, because I think the fact that Rock lived such a closeted life and had never really been a part of gay liberation, I think, was still felt to be a bit of a betrayal by many gay men in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's an edge that Rock Hudson's Home Movies, that this movie does not have, or this documentary does not have.
Yes.
And so I think that those decontextualized moments are played for a little bit more lighthearted than they are in maybe it's this other movie that I'm referencing.
Yes.
Which is good. I mean, I think that there is some value to having a little bit more of a lighthearted touch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that isn't to say that obviously there are people in this documentary who highlight the fact that Rock wasn't willing or able to, you know, openly acknowledge his lifestyle. Like, I think that's one of the points mainly raised by Armistead Maupin, the famously mm-hmm. the author of Tales of the City,
yeah.
who, you know, knew and had had sex with and had a longstanding sort of friends with benefits relationship with Hudson.
Yeah.
And it's like, why don't you just come out? Like, I could help mm-hmm. you with this. But Hudson just didn't want to do it. I think that that's an interesting phenomenon myself.
Yeah, and it was interesting in this particular documentary because this is where I learned that when it came to sort of publicly outing Rock Hudson after his announcement that he had AIDS, of course, the question came up, well, how did he get it? If in the United States at the time, at the very least, AIDS was thought of as a gay disease. So, of course, there was a lot of innuendo, a lot of rumors. But in this documentary, Armistead Maupin admits that he's the one that, after Rock's death, is like, I'm the one that kind of told everybody, yes, he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love about it is that although he doesn't quite come right out and say it, there is at least an acknowledgement in this documentary that that was Armistead Maupin's choice, regardless of what Rock Hudson might have wanted for himself. Because that's the thing about this debate about what Rock Hudson might have owed to gay men or anything like that. That whole discourse assumes that Rock Hudson is not allowed to make his own choices for himself.
Right. Which is deeply, I mean, especially given that we're always about autonomy and, like, individual agency, like, that's a vexed question. And
yes.
It's one that I think the documentary skirts around, doesn't really get into it too much except with Maupin's, like, his own testimony. But it is the ongoing question is, what role do public figures owe to the community of which they're a part to mm-hmm. advocate for that community?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a particularly vexed one for Hudson, coming of age as he does in The Age of the Closet. And especially the really profoundly restrictive one of the Hollywood closet.
Exactly. So now let's talk about that a bit more, because before we started recording, you and I were discussing sort of the nature of the closet for Hollywood stars of that era, and how it maybe doesn't make sense to think of that as just being sort of the same closet that us regular folks have to navigate.
Right.
As queer subjects. You made a really good point when you referred to Hollywood as the Dream Factory, using that that sort of long-standing term for Hollywood that's been around now for a while. And then I said something like, well, that makes a lot of sense to me to think of it in this way. Because if we think of the closet in just sort of the normal way, we forget how highly constructed all celebrities' personas were
right
back in the past. It's not just that Rock Hudson as a gay man would have had to have kept his sexual identity secret. It's that his entire persona as a celebrity was itself an artificial creation
correct
of Hollywood.
Right.
And that was the normal thing for Hollywood at the time.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting, and I'm going to put on my classic Hollywood historian hat for a moment. As you alluded to, like, it is important to recognize that in the classic Hollywood era, like, even in the 50s when the studio system was, like, beginning to crumble, studios did control almost every aspect of a star's life. Like, it was a very deliberate, constructive activity. As Jenny Basinger points out in The Star Machine, like, it was like a machine. Like, people got fed into it, they were cultivated, they were put in certain kinds of roles to generate interest in them and to sort of establish a personality. There was an entire industry of gossip magazines who were and gossip columnists, like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, who were very plugged into Hollywood and fed gossip by Hollywood. All of it, you know, as Rock himself acknowledges in an interview that is aired in the documentary, like stars were also just sort of controlled by the studios in terms of where they lived, what they ate, like all of their needs were seen to. So I think that what sets Rock apart, and I think the documentary highlights this repeatedly, is that he was pretty okay with that system. Like,
exactly.
He's not one of those troublemaking stars like, I don't know, Betty Davis or Olivia de Havilland, who like bucked the system and often would sue the system to get what they wanted, most notably when Havilland's success in breaking the contract system. It seems to me that, and I think this is the documentary's argument, that part of the reason Hudson was so successful and why the studios were willing to sort of help him along with his keeping his sexuality secret, aside from his box office appeal, always a big part of it, was that he went along to get along. And that goes a long way in a very, like, oligarchic, autocratic system like Hollywood, like the studios tended to be.
Exactly. And, you know, again, just as a little reminder for us regular folks who might be listening to this sort of thing, it's that you really do have to put yourself in the mind space of someone who has every aspect of your life sort of managed and controlled for you, because your image itself is a major commodity. That's something that most of us, even today, don't really understand, even in this sort of hypermediated world that we live in now with social media and all that kind of stuff. It's just different now. Like, there is this idea of authenticity that we have that really didn't exist for Hollywood stars back in the day.
Well, I mean, it only insofar as, like, that people wanted to see their stars being authentic. Like, there was still that desire.
Well, they wanted to see the carefully crafted image that was called authentic.
Right, exactly.
Despite how artificial it actually
exactly.
was.
I mean, that's the function in part of fan magazines, is to sort of provide intimate gazes at the Hollywood lifestyle. Like, this is the part that Richard Dyer talks about in his discussions of stardom, like the yearning for authenticity, even though we also recognize that it's all artificial.
Exactly.
Which I think that's one of the things that fascinated me most about this documentary, and it was one of the questions you asked me when we were doing the pregame. Like, why is it that Hudson was so successful, not just at, you know, as far as getting the studios to like him, but why was he so successful in propagating that image of himself to the public for so long? And I think that the reason is because, even though I'm, you know, obviously lots of gay men in the gossip circuits knew of his sexuality, and I think that many average Americans probably also knew something, but the power, never underestimate the American viewing public's capacity to have a double consciousness. And because Rock Hudson, like, physically, as well as then the roles he played, so perfectly distilled what post-war America envisioned masculinity to look like, there's an ability to sort of hold those two things in constant tension. And I think that Rock himself held them in constant tension. Like, you know, I think he was one of those people who held the private part of himself and also the public part of himself in a sort of delicate dance. And I think, And I think many of the people who comment in this doc say this as well, or allude to it, that he just literally lived two lives. Like, mm-hmm. I think that he was just literally a split personality. There was public rock and private rock.
Yeah. And again, that's a very common thing for a celebrity of that era to do.
Right.
And it's one of those things where it's like, as long as everyone agrees to play the part, it almost doesn't actually matter what you do in your real life. As long as you agree to play the part of the, for Rock Hudson, the straight, dashing, handsome man, you can kind of do whatever you want, which is what he did. As you were pointing out before, the documentary makes it very clear that unlike some other gay male stars of the time, he didn't live really in the closet in that same kind of way. He had sexual encounters with pretty much anybody he wanted to. Even the documentary even mentions times where he was like taken out to a big bathhouse and just kind of walked around. And of course, he's a huge star. People recognized him there, and that was fine.
Right. I mean, he's also a huge person. Like, I mean, that's the thing. He's a towering giant of a man. Like, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, unlike many Hollywood stars who are very small, he was truly gigantic and had that sort of towering frame. That's part of the reason that he so easily manifested and embodied, literally speaking, the ideals of American masculinity. Mm-hmm. Like, as the documentary itself points out again and again, he was the guy that women wanted to be with and men wanted to be. And then, of course, there's always the subset of men that wanted to also be with him. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's really a fascinating aspect of his personality that this brings up.
What about the extra small subset of men who simultaneously wanted to be him and be with him?
Well, that's the thing, right? Because there is the interview that one gay star whose name is escaping me at the moment, but was, you know, played Rock Hudson's son in a TV miniseries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that he was one of those cases who, you know, he came out late in life, but was, I think, caught in that similar kind of extremely paradigmatic queer dilemma. Like, so many of us, when we feel desire for another man, it's also tied up in our own narcissism to some mm-hmm. degree. Like, we see and are attracted to the people that we would also like to be. Not always. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think that is a common phenomenon. Yes. With gay desire in particular.
Definitely.
I mean, I know that's the case with me. But anyway, so, and it's also interesting to me, and this was a thought that occurred to me as we were talking about the history of Hollywood and how Rock's, you know, his own stardom so neatly maps onto the history of Hollywood in the post-war era. Like, he's a star in the Hollywood system, then he sort of moves into television as TV itself kind of became a much more prominent part of the American landscape. It's just a really fascinating degree to which his own star persona is so tied up with American media.
Yes.
Like, and then, of course, most tragically, he becomes gossip fodder for the tabloids, mm-hmm. and who savage him in the 80s.
Yes, but let's actually go back and pick up something that the documentary does mention about him being fodder for gossip. It's like, near the end of his life, the gossip finally caught up to him. Yeah. Because he had been so skillful at avoiding it for many decades. Because, again, he lived life as a gay man, but in a world, of course, where the public almost had this vested interest in not seeing it.
Right.
But, you know, gossip columnists do what they do. They try to dig up dirt. They have, you know, they knew. But there was actually an agreement made to not cover Rock Hudson. Like, that was actually a thing that happened, that the documentary points out, is that instead, sadly, Rock Hudson's agent gave up another actor, the star Tab Hunter,
yep.
to the gossip columnist and asked them to run a story about his previous experiences with men and how he had gotten in trouble with that, to keep them from writing a story about Rock Hudson's dalliances.
Right, which is really, I mean, is one of the most tragic stories in Hollywood. And at some point, maybe we'll, on this podcast, we'll talk about Tab Hunter Confidential, which is mm-hmm. a documentary about Tab Hunter, as you yes. might imagine. And you're right, and I think that it's really emblematic of the sort of cutthroat world of Hollywood that's the sort of set of circumstances that mm-hmm. took place.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things about that for me and watching this documentary, because I had heard that before but I didn't really think about it very much, but watching that play out in the documentary, it made me really think about how all of this stuff was happening without the direct involvement of Rock Hudson himself.
Right.
Again, these are decisions that again highlight how controlled celebrities' personas really were. I mean, that's a pretty underhanded move for Hudson's agent to make, to do this, to sacrifice somebody else for the benefit of Rock Hudson. Rock Hudson maybe never even knew that this happened.
Right. Now, it is interesting that you bring up Henry Wilson, who is the... If this documentary has a villain, it would be Henry Wilson.
Yes.
Which is pretty true in most accounts of mm-hmm. Rock Hudson's life. And if you've ever seen Ryan Murphy's Hollywood, mm-hmm. who is played by Jim Parsons, who, it turns out, really does bear a strike. He's much more attractive than the real Henry Wilson. But he really does kind of have a physical resemblance to him. And, of course, Rock Hudson is a major character within Hollywood, like the series Hollywood, which has a much more, shall we say, loosey-goosey relationship with the truth.
Yes, yes.
But even so, like, if there's any character from this, the drama that the documentary unfolds, it's definitely Henry Wilson, who was a really noxious character. And mm-hmm. I mean, one of the interview subjects who was one of Hudson's lovers/boyfriends was like that awful or that evil agent of his.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a pretty, you know, confirmed and established fact about Rock Hudson's life, is that Wilson was a true terrible person
mm-hmm.
Who was willing to do whatever he had to do to keep his stars successful, because of course that meant his own success.
Yeah. But then think about what that means from the perspective of the stars in question. It's kind of sucks that this, you know, this almost Machiavellian evil figure is doing all of these things that actually materially benefit you.
Mm-hmm.
Puts you in a position where, what would you say?
Right. I don't know what I would say. And that's the thing that I think is most fascinating about Wilson as a character, is, you know, he does emerge as this, you know, sort of Svengali-like figure. And, you know, obviously the documentary also doesn't shy away from the fact that he was willing and able to use sexual favors. Like, it was the sort of implied coin of the realm
mm-hmm.
in that particular world, which is really disturbing if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you're talking about an agent asking for sexual favors to work for somebody, you just described a whole lot of Hollywood.
Yes, exactly. It's like he is the Harvey Weinstein of his era. But I don't want...
I mean, so were lots of people.
Well, yes, exactly. So, and I do think that one of the things that All Out Heaven allowed does well is to sort of help us to understand this very specific system within which Rock Hudson emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really valuable, because as classic Hollywood, as a period, sort of withdraws from our temporal landscape. Like, it's, you know, there are very few surviving stars from that period. You know, the recent upheavals at TCM suggest that people don't value it as much as they probably should. That's why I think these documentaries are even more important, because they really help us to, you know, understand this world and those that emerged out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that isn't to say, obviously, that the documentary also doesn't show, like, his really deep personal friendships. And that's yes. something I really appreciated as well, is that we get a lot of commentary from people, as you say, like Piper Laurie, like Elizabeth Taylor, and of course, the Divine Doris Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that we got to see this more intimate part of him, because it's so... You know, Rock Hudson, both in his life and subsequently, was so much larger than life that his narrative becomes somewhat overdetermined.
Yeah.
Like, we think we know everything already. Like, it's one of those things that we just have a sense of. And one of the things I think that's really valuable about docs like this one is to sort of give a more nuanced, deeply personal and intimate portrait that rescues Rock somewhat from his own legacy.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, because one of the things that I didn't realize until watching this particular documentary is how well-liked Rock Hudson was by his contemporaries in Hollywood. That was something that somehow had escaped me, and all of the stuff that I did know about Rock Hudson, I'd never come across that. And it was really listening to Linda Evans talk about her, you know, her turn with Rock Hudson on Dynasty, talking about how she just thought he was such a good guy.
Yep.
And that got echoed by so many other people in the documentary, that he just seemed like such a good guy
mm-hmm.
that I feel like it's almost kind of a shame that his legacy hasn't been about that.
Right.
Because just think about how nice it would be to have a story about a legendary Hollywood figure who was just a nice dude. Think about what that would be like to have that kind of story.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one, you know, again and again, as we get these sentiments. I mean, Doris Day says the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's, and, you know, she obviously alludes to the fact that people would often ask her, you know, did you know he was gay? She's like, and as you know, her response, and I think this the interview with her was, what, in the 80s? Maybe the 90s, so, yeah. Something like that. Just judging the way she appeared. You know, she said something to the effect of, like, it wasn't my business, and it's not my business to speak about Rock Hudson's personal life. The only thing I want to say is that he was a wonderful man, and mm-hmm. I loved him. Like, I think that that's very emblematic, one, of women of her age, who are very circumspect, mm-hmm. and also, like, just a really classy move.
Yeah.
And then, three, of course, she looks great. Like, she looked great for her whole life. Like, up until her death, she looked amazing.
Yeah, and I actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, too, because that's something that I wanted to bring up when I was talking before about sort of the system of Hollywood and having the double lives and all that kind of stuff. The idea of privacy, you know, the idea that a person just kind of wouldn't make a big deal out of their personal lives may seem completely foreign to us today. It might seem completely antithetical to everything that we understand about people now, because we're all clamoring for attention.
Right.
But that's not how everyone used to be.
Right.
And not just as celebrities who had a major, who had an image to protect, but just as people. You didn't necessarily go around telling everybody all your business. That's something that I think we should also kind of remind viewers who are maybe our age and younger.
Right.
So that they can understand people from those earlier generations.
Right. Circumspection goes a long way with people of a certain, of that particular generation.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, like, not everyone needs, and again, whatever the studios were able to propagate about stars' private lives were always manufactured. Like, you know, the intimate portraits that we get of Rock Hudson himself, for example, that the documentary shows, were often just that. They were just fake. Which is, you know, an interesting intertext with Joan Crawford, who we talked about, you know, a couple months ago, who was herself a product of the star system.
Yep.
But one of the other things I really appreciated about this was that it allowed us to see the many intimate friendships with men that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something, again, that gets somewhat, I don't want to say glossed over, but kind of, like, obliterated by the blizzard of, like, commentary that always accompanies his star persona after his death. Like, you know, he's the guy who died of AIDS and lived in the closet. But that there's a lot going on there. Like, it's much more complicated than that summary usually would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, obviously, I alluded to earlier Armistead Maupin, and I really, really loved his parts of the documentary in particular. One, because they're one of the ones we get to see, like, it's a face-to-face interview.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also, I mean, he is one of the sort of great gay voices in literature.
Definitely.
And so I think that it's really kind of valuable, and I actually had no idea that he'd had affairs with Rock Hudson. Like, I actually didn't know that before I watched it. Mm-hmm. And so I really valued his perspective about this, and quite frankly, he was just the avuncular gay grandpa that we all want, I think. And so I really enjoyed those parts of the documentary where he was, you know, speaking of his own encounters with Rock Hudson and also, you know, their enduring friendship even after those erotic encounters.
Mm-hmm. And I love how that hearing these stories and that all focused on sort of the importance of friendship for Rock Hudson. Again, it's sort of a nice challenge to sort of the narrative of the sad life of being in the closet. And, of course, Rock Hudson, you know, very famously didn't have, you know, like, a lifelong partner the way that some of the other men who were featured in this documentary have had.
Like Ross Hunter, as a notable example.
Exactly. But hearing the people talk about Rock's life is a reminder that not everyone has to have that in order to be happy.
Oh, that's a very good point.
That it's like he had great, wonderful, enduring friendships. And for some people, that's honestly enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really fascinating thing that the documentary, like, brings up but doesn't, like, explicitly address.
Yeah.
You know, because as you say, like, some people, and many gay men in particular, don't necessarily need a monogamous relationship or a long-standing relationship to be perfectly content. And I mean, from all appearances, it's not as if Rock seemed like he was particularly vexed. He just seemed to be, like, fucking a lot of guys.
Yeah.
And I mean, in the pre-AIDS era, like, that was the dream.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was living it even before, like, the sort of liberated 70s that predate the AIDS crisis.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, to remind contemporary audiences, the idea of lifelong partnership for gay men being a mainstream idea is very, very, very new.
Right, and even still very contested.
I can only imagine that for a lot of men of Rock's generation who were gay, the way that he lived his life might have been sort of the ideal model that you carried around in your head. Because it's not like you could get married to a man.
Right.
I mean, the concept was laughable. back in the day. Like, it was so unserious that when brought up, it was thought of as a joke.
Right.
Like, that's how far beyond our understanding it was back then.
Right, which I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the other things that All of Heaven Allowed brings up is, of course, before Hudson's being outed in the 80s, when he, because of the AIDS crisis, was what started out as a joke, but quickly turned into something much more toxic, which of course is the moment whenever the newspapers were, or they were funnily pointing out that he was going to get married to Jim Nabors,
mm-hmm.
and it was going to be like Rock Pile, because of course he was famous for playing Gomer Pyle, but it became something more sinister than just the sort of gay joke that it was originally intended to be, and mm-hmm. from all accounts it kind of destroyed their friendship, because the tabloids were just feasting on it.
Yes.
Which is doubly ironic, since the late Jim Nabors was himself also gay,
mm-hmm.
Which I actually did not know until he came out late in life.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, that's one of those moments when we see, like, the closest that Hudson came to having his truth exposed before the 80s was that particular incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, you know, that they talked about how that was sort of the worst thing the tabloids had done to him.
Exactly.
And how, you know, it seemed particularly unfair to the people who were talking about it, because he seemed like such a nice guy, and it seemed he seemed undeserving of this kind of critical mm-hmm. attention.
Exactly. But the way the documentary talks about his response to it also makes a lot of sense to me, for what I do know about Rock Hudson, is that, of course, like you said, it was the thing that actually seemed to hurt his feelings
right.
the most, but his response was to just sort of let it go.
Yeah.
Because as he points out in the documentary, in some interview that's included in the documentary, is that to argue about it would just draw even more attention to it. So you just let it go by.
Yeah. But I mean, again and again, as we see throughout the documentary, we see the many gay men that he had sort of flings with other than Armistead. We learn, for example, that apparently he was well endowed, which, I mean, I suspected, but, you know, you just never know. Apparently, I mean, I will say that Rock Hudson does seem to have BDE,
wow.
big dick energy. For
my apologies to the audience.
They know what they're getting in for. They know how uncouth I am sometimes. I mean, we're talking about a man having gay, like promiscuous gay sex. What could be more
wow.
uncouth than that?
Wow, we are talking about a Hollywood icon's life.
Yeah, he was a huge slut, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the guy was like, what did he say? Something to the effect of like, I just couldn't take that up my ass or something. Like, because there was a bluntness to it that I really appreciated from some of these gay voices, which has an extra layer of, like, resonance, because so many men of that generation are dead.
Yes.
And dead specifically of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that one of the things I appreciated particularly about this is that, you know, the director went out of his way to find these living, and I almost said relics, but that's not what I mean. These living voices from an previous era of gay life,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, it's so common in our youth-obsessed culture to sort of brush those old gays under the rug, but mm-hmm. I really, really love that the documentary brought them out and gave them their chance to talk about mm-hmm. their relationship with Rock.
Yes, and one thing that the documentary does well, mainly because of the participation of these men and the sophisticated way in which they talk about their sex lives and all of that kind of stuff, is that on one hand, I appreciate the frankness
mm-hmm.
in talking about these things coming from men of that generation, for whom openness was a much more political act than it is today.
Right.
But at the same time, there's still quite a degree of discretion
right.
shown by these men when talking about these things that I actually really appreciate. I feel like our contemporary takes on these things get way too lewd, way too fast.
Is that a dig at me?
A little bit. But in thinking about the way that Rock Hudson presented his own life, I like the fact that they were willing to come forward and speak the truth, but to still shade it a little bit.
Mm. Other than the dick in the ass comment. Mm.
But even then, it's like that wasn't quite as explicitly stated in the documentary as you're saying it right now.
Yes, it was! He literally said almost those exact words.
No, he did not.
Listeners, if you would care to watch the documentary, and you can prove me correct on this one.
He does refer to it in a clear way, but he doesn't make it quite as explicit as you're saying.
Well, anyway. But, I mean, I think that you know, one of the other interview subjects is himself HIV positive and has been that way. And
since the 80s.
Yeah. Since the 80s. So I think once again, like, it's really valuable to see these voices and to hear these people speak from that era. Because I think that in the common, what do you want to call it, popular imagination, there's this sense that, well, that whole generation is gone. But no, they aren't. There are still some of them left, and we need to sort of cherish them for what they are providing us, this window into a previous period of experience.
Wait, are you saying that there are still old people who exist?
That is true. There are old people. And shocking, right? And there are worth listening to. Like, that's the other thing. And I think that's really valuable. And one of the individuals was one of the one, like, sort of long-standing, like, relationships that Rock had. Like, they traveled around the country. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's fun to imagine Rock had to just be like, I'm just going to go out and travel with my boyfriend. Like, you know, it's just extremely astounding and joyful to see Rock Hudson, who, for so many, who is the sort of emblem of the closet and the perniciousness of the closet, living the double life, who really just seemed to, like, enjoy and revel in what his privilege brought him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something kind of liberating about that. And that's an image of Rock Hudson that we don't always see.
Exactly. I feel like Rock Hudson, like any other celebrity, tends to be sort of the repository of people projecting their own values, their own feelings outward, rather than us taking the time to figure out what that person may have thought or what that person feels or what they value.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's like, again, talking about sort of the perniciousness of the closet and all that kind of stuff. That's fine, but that doesn't necessarily reflect the way that Hudson thought about his own life.
Right. Which, of course, you know, comes in also when he's dying of AIDS. Like, mm-hmm. you know, his publicist, or I forget who it was, maybe his publicist or someone, was, like, talking about how, like, even his own death and or his dying months were marred by the sort of tabloids clamoring for more information, like, more data to feed the monstrous maw of mm-hmm. like public attention.
Yes.
And how that was really, even that was devastating. I mean, because it's bad enough to have contracted this disease that is, you know, has no cure,
mm-hmm.
and to endure like the stigma associated with it, but also to like have even the last little bit of your own privacy stripped away from you, mm-hmm. is really devastating. And I think that that's one of the sort of rich pathos, you know, driven moments of this documentary. Mm-hmm.
You know, especially for someone who seemed to value that privacy. It's,
right.
It is not like it's something where he just didn't want people to sort of to know that he had AIDS or to see him in his decline. No, throughout his life, he seemed to value that degree of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why couldn't people at least let him have that?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, and it's also fitting that then we get sort of attention paid to the women who stood by him at the end, like mm-hmm. Elizabeth Taylor, pardon me, most notably, who was like, well, do something, bitch. Like, yes. She said to herself, like, again, I appreciate that we have these wonderful women who stood by him even in the darkest moments.
Mm-hmm.
And if I recall correctly, I read the biography, like, from, I think his name's Mark Harris, who is a pretty firm voice throughout this documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Liz Taylor was one of the people who was with him as he was dying.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really powerful. To know that she was such an advocate. And of course, everyone who knows anything about Liz Taylor knows that she was an advocate for the gays. There wasn't a gay man in Hollywood, I think, that Liz Taylor didn't try to adopt.
Pretty much.
And I wonder if the same was true of Doris Day, because, you know, she was obviously a gay icon, but mm-hmm. not as much of a gay best friend as Liz Taylor, who mm-hmm. also was very good friends with Monty Clift, yeah, notably.
I mean, Liz Taylor loved gay men so much she married one.
I mean, I love gay men so much that I married one. And so I think that overall, I really valued All That Heaven Allowed. Like, I think that it allowed me, even as someone who, you know, I will say that having earned a PhD writing about classic Hollywood, you know, there's a lot that I know about classic Hollywood, but this challenged some of my own sort of unthinking assumptions about what I know and what I think about Rock Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a really valuable thing, because as I said, I think so much of what we sometimes understand or think we understand about celebrities is overshadowed by their posthumous legacies.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes it is really valuable to go back and revisit them.
Yeah, and that's particularly important when you're talking about stars of that era, whose images were so carefully manufactured, in some cases just flat out falsified.
Even his name was fake.
Exactly. So going in back and figuring out who these people, quote, really were, it's interesting and it's exciting and it's always so revealing, because so much of it subverts what we think we already know, because what we already know was based on a fiction. It's not like we just didn't know much. It's that we thought we knew stuff that we didn't actually know.
Right, which, I mean, not to get too meta, but I mean, that is one of the things that's interesting about this documentary and all such documentaries, is that it's doing the very thing that we, you know, we're just arguing or pointing out that the studio system itself was about, which is constructing a star image. Mm-hmm. And this documentary takes its own place in constructing mm-hmm. the image of who Rock Hudson was. And I, you know, we'll never know, obviously, to the extent, to what extent Hudson felt anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always mediated through his, you know, his own interviews, which we get his own voice frequently, but also what he said to his friends and so forth. But I mean, how much can any of us really know about one another or ourselves, for exactly. that matter? You know? So I think that those are all sort of things that are in the air that this documentary helps to bring out.
Yes. And that's one reason why I appreciate the light touch of this documentary. Like you pointed out earlier when we were talking, that we don't have sort of a central narrator for this, the way a lot of documentaries will have sort of one central voice that kind of narrates throughout. We don't really get that with this. We just hear a lot of different voices. And I like that approach because it sort of highlights the idea that what we're getting is just a bunch of different people's perspectives on Rock Hudson's life, as opposed to someone that's claiming to be sort of the authority.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only person who could be that authority is Rock Hudson, and he's gone.
Right. And we do, as I said, we do get some vestiges of his voice and his own commentary about his life. But he was, again, one of those stars who just knew how to project a certain image to the public and was not particularly demonstrative in terms of his personal life.
Yeah, and I can get that. I feel like, you know, when I try to imagine my life if I were a big star or something like that, I feel like I would probably be a bit like that myself, as someone who also tends to appreciate my privacy.
You do.
Is that I wouldn't necessarily want everyone knowing every little thing about me. I would be much happier giving people sort of a carefully cultivated image and then asking them to leave me alone beyond that.
I think that counts towards me, too. Well, that seems like a good place to end. So give us a few moments, and we'll be right back to do a deep cut, and we'll also do a little PSK. So as I alluded to earlier, and I didn't really think about this until after I was setting up for this pod, I was like, I actually do have a deep cut with Rock Hudson. As I said earlier, I did sort of fall in love with him while watching these movies with my grandmother. And, of course, I don't think my grandma knew, or not until the 80s, that Rock was gay. Like, she seemed to be one of those people who I've talked about who could really have a double consciousness as far as, like, maybe knowing someone was gay but not willing to even sort of address what that might mean. I'm the perfect example of that phenomenon. But I remember, even as a kid, like 5, 6, being just sort of enraptured by how handsome he was. Like, my desire for him obviously was nascent. I was 5 or 4. But it just, you know, there was something about the way that he was both very ruggedly handsome, but also very sensitive. Like, mm-hmm. there's a real sensitivity. And it emerges in even his sex comedies with Doris Day, you know, in Pillow Talk, for example, where he's a straight man pretending to be a, or he's a gay man pretending to be a straight man pretending to be a gay man. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a sort of nesting doll of identity at play. I didn't, all of that was completely over my head. You know, it was not at all on my radar. But I like to think that even 5-year-old TJ perhaps saw a kindred spirit in a little bit of Rock Hudson. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I feel drawn to him even now. Like, I'm just sort of enraptured by him when I see him on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just horny all the time. Maybe that's what it is. But it's something beyond that. Like, it's obviously erotic desire, but it's also, there's just something I find really appealing and comforting about him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of all these feelings together. So I really can understand, in a really deep emotional level, why so many people over the years felt such attachment to Rock Hudson as a star.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I feel like one thing that my earliest individual memory of not just being sort of told about Rock Hudson, but seeing him, was actually referenced in the documentary. It's the scene in I Love Lucy where he shows up in an episode.
Yes.
Where Lucy and Ethel have taken a weekend away from the boys to try to get away from them. And then they meet Rock Hudson, who is a friend of Ricky's at that point. And Ricky has called Rock Hudson to try to get him to convince the girls to kind of come back home. But seeing him there and seeing, remembering that from being a child, I remember going, oh, this is the Rock Hudson that I've heard about, and thinking of him as being so attractive and desirable, but in a way that wasn't quite so sexy, so less than the I'm horny all the time, the way that DJ just pointed out for himself, but more in the idea that he was just presented as this sort of like idealized man,
mm-hmm.
in a way that didn't feel so overtly sexual, because of course it was I Love Lucy, nothing's overtly sexual in
right.
I Love Lucy, and that's pretty typical of the way that I read movies from that era, anyway, compared to contemporary movies, movies from the past are very de-sexed.
That's true.
They couldn't be explicitly sexual in the way that movies are now. And so there's something about his sort of masculine beauty that stands out to me as being not sexual, but still very beautiful and very manly.
Yes.
And so I tend to read him in a very different way.
Ah, fascinating. Now, I do remember when my mom told me, like, I must have been in my teens that he was gay and, you know, had picked up young men. And I was like, I think I can't imagine that I didn't think something to the effect of, oh, to have been one of those young men. But anyway. So the other thing I wanted to just address was two other viewings that we may or may not do an episode of the pod, but I just wanted to draw them to people's attention. So one of them is the new film Nimona, which is the new animated film that just came out on Netflix. So I summarize it to my friend Bridget as basically it's an animated film about a gay knight who befriends a sort of shape-shifting creature slash young girl. She's not a girl because she specifically says she's not a girl. But it's a really fascinating sort of allegory about transness and non-binary. And of course, it's visually stunning and it's quite heartfelt and it's really delightful. And I really think people should watch it because I think there's value in sort of supporting these projects. Because mm-hmm. God knows there's been a, you know, a sort of rash of cancellations of queer-helmed projects over the last year. And there's still so much backlash against representation. So I think that supporting these kinds of movies like Nimona is really important. And also, like I said, it's just really good. And it's, you know, a beautiful, lushly animated film.
Okay.
So if you like animation and you like queerness, which, you know, who doesn't, then I definitely recommend that. And then, of course, one of the other things that we've been watching was Gods and Monsters, the Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser pairing that mm-hmm. focuses on Ian McKellen as James Whale, who befriends Fraser's Clayton Boone, to quote the crazy ex-girlfriend, a male ingenue.
Wait, that wasn't a documentary?
It was not. It is highly fictionalized, as it turns out, but I do think it's one of Ian McKellen's, like, tour de force performances. Like, he is so extraordinary as James Whale. And Brendan Fraser is just gorgeous.
So you mean he was playing, he wasn't just himself?
Well, I mean, that's the thing about, I appreciate about Ian McKellen's star text, is that he is both indelibly himself, but also, like, can easily mutate that into any role that he commands. Mm-hmm. Like, we also watched Richard III, where he also is very Ian McKellen, but mm-hmm. somehow also really Richard III.
Yep.
He's really one of those people who I'm always conscious that I'm watching him, but also he's lost himself in the role. It's a kind of a double consciousness that's always the case with stars. But I think Ian McKellen is just so extraordinary of a performer that he achieves that in a way I very rarely otherwise see. And also, Brendan Fraser is just really pretty to look at.
Of course. And that's the only reason you need to watch the movie, folks.
Right. Long before he played gay in The Whale, he was playing... He's not really gay in this movie, but, you know, it's putting
he's
his...
He's decidedly not gay in this movie.
Yes, he is. But I really appreciate what this film does, even with its sort of phantasmagorical approach to Whale's life and his death.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of three recommendations. So I definitely think you should watch those. Again, Nimona on Netflix, Richard III, and Gods and Monsters. The latter two, well, Gods and Monsters is still streaming on Paramount Plus. I don't think Richard III is streaming anywhere, so you might have to get it on DVD.
You could also read the play.
You could read the play, Richard III, but it, you know, there's a certain performance that is just indelibly marked in my mind. So I think that's a good place to call it quits for this week. We've done a pretty good job, I think, and, you know, we don't like to take this on too much time.
Exactly. I think we've said what needed to be said.
We have said what needed to be said. Brevity, as they say, is the soul of wit. Is that Shakespeare?
Quite possibly.
It seems like something that's Shakespeare.
Brevity is the soul of lingerie, is Dorothy Parker.
Well, as she also says, you can lead a horde of culture, but you can't make her think. But anyway, I'm living proof of that. Anyway, I digress. As always, you, for the moment, can still follow me on Twitter at TJ West in the number 3. You can also follow me on Instagram at Thomas West in the number 3. You can also follow our Instagram for Queens at Queens of the Bees, all one word. And always, as always, we really appreciate all of our listeners. We, you know, love coming before you every week or so to talk about films and, you know, and TV shows and all the things we love with queer culture. But it would really mean the world to us if you could take a little extra time and rate us or rank us on Apple TV. What am I saying? Not Apple TV. On Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would also do us the favor of maybe even, I don't know, telling your friends about us. Whatever. We're still a very small podcast. We have a devoted fan base, but we want to grow that fan base because, you know, as Aaron alluded to earlier, I'm a bit of a fame whore, and I yearn for success and fame. So if you would like to partake in that and help that to come to pass, yes, which I know you do, then please, by all means, rate or rank us wherever you find us.
Please make TJ's dreams come true.
I mean, Aaron will also benefit if I make lots of money from being a worldwide success as a podcast, so please, you know, take that into consideration.
Yes, I want to be a kept man.
I mean, I also want to be a kept man, which I kind of am, so I have made it. Anyway, so that's all for this week. So for Queens of the Bees, I am TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will talk to you soon.